Hi, everybody. It's David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 43. Few things happening in the publishing world. I think I neglected to mention last week that Audible has introduced a sort of audio version of Kindle Unlimited, where you pay a certain fee and you can listen to as many titles as you can stand in a given month. And there have been rumors for a while that this was coming. Right now, they have limited it to specific genres or subgenres. I think it might just be romance at this point. They're definitely focusing on a genre where there's a reputation of readers really, really being hungry for lots of titles and consuming them very fast. So they're doing this on a limited basis as, I guess, a test balloon to see if it's worth expanding to the rest of their catalog. So, you know, interesting development, something that's been rumored for a while. And we'll just kind of see how that all shakes out. It's not certain that it's going to work out well for authors, but, you know, maybe then again it will. Sometimes what these borrowing programs comes down to is, are readers who would have paid full price for your book instead going to consume your book in a borrowing program for less money than you would have made on that sale? And certainly some of them will, but are you also reaching other audience segments that would not have tried your book otherwise or might not have discovered you otherwise? And if so, that's probably making up for what you lose per unit when people who would have paid for your book move over to the borrowing. So, you know, it's an interesting thing to keep an eye on, but it does seem to be the way the market is moving, where a lot of vendors and distributors are going to have borrowing programs for pay. So something to watch. Another thing that's going on is with CreateSpace. Now, something CreateSpace, in case you don't know, we've discussed it on a way back early episode when we were discussing our publishing options. CreateSpace is a company that will publish your paperback. They're owned by Amazon, and they're an amazing deal compared to somebody like Lulu.com. But also, depending on what your needs are, for an awful lot of people, they're better than either Ingram Spark or Lightning Source. You can't do discounts, you know, with Lightning Source, you can control a lot of discounts. That gives your book an appeal to bookstores. You can't do things like returnability and steep discounts with CreateSpace, although you can make the book available for sale at bookstores. But unlike Ingram or Lightning Source, you don't have to pay any setup fees. You don't have to pay revision fees to change anything about your files. You don't have to pay annual listing fees. And your return, depending on, you know, your pricing strategy, is reasonable for books sold within the U.S. When you start expanding the distribution, it's not great. But anyway, CreateSpace has become the choice for most individual indie authors who want an easy and affordable way to produce paperbacks and put them out there for sale. One of the bonuses that CreateSpace did was, in addition to putting your book on online bookstores, they would offer you what they call the CreateSpace e-store. And it really wasn't a store. It was just basically a private link that you could use to your book. And any books bought there, ordered directly through CreateSpace, you got a much larger chunk of royalty on. I'm not sure why they did it that way or what the benefit was. I never really used those links because, yes, you could get more per unit, but I believed that the visibility on Amazon and the boost to my rankings for every book sold made it more beneficial to really just drive people to my Amazon pages to buy those books. I think the rankings, the also bots, things like that are much more important than making an extra buck or whatever off of your paperback sales on that private CreateSpace store. Well, anyway, they're doing away with that store. And so now you can only sell through their normal distribution channels. Don't know what the reasons are. A lot of authors aren't aware or just don't care. Some are pretty upset. I think those are authors who move very few units and were really enjoying those extra couple dollars they got here and there for directing people to the CreateSpace stores. For me, like I said, it's not something I chose to make use of, so it's not a big deal to me, but it's a development some people are talking about. One other thing I'd like to talk about, and you know, it's just on my mind because of the immediate impact on me and some friends. But basically, just in the past few days, I found out about two different pretty solid indie presses that are closing their doors. Well, one is closing its doors. One is technically not closing its doors, but they're canceling all of their contracts and delisting all of their titles and are planning on regrouping in 2018 and coming back in the future. But for all practical purposes and for the sakes of the authors who are published by them, they're shuttering their doors. I'm not ready to name either name yet, although at least one is already being discussed. But anyway, just some observations about this whole situation, because I know that a lot of indies will still take that option of going with a small press, and it's not always the wrong thing to do. But first of all, be careful, because just because a publishing company offers you a contract doesn't mean they're not going to turn around and go out of business the next week. That's pretty much what's happened with the company that I just learned about earlier today. They've still been issuing new contracts. I know of two different people who just got two book deals from them that are now officially canceled. Another company, literally days before they made their announcement that they were insolvent, they were talking about new distribution lines they were editing and all this big rah-rah stuff. And it's really, really weird. It's like all the owners of these publishing companies just fiddle while Rome burns. Yeah, it's late in the day. I'm tired. I haven't had enough coffee. But anyway, so that's a little frustrating to me. But the one thing that both of these publishing houses have in common that I've observed has to do with the motivation for a lot of indies who go with these kind of publishers, and that is that both of them were trying to take a step up in the print distribution world. Basically, in the past, they operated the way Severed Press does, the way Griffinwood does, and lots of other publishing houses. They had ebook distribution, they had print-on-demand paperback distribution without returnability, and in some cases, they had maybe audiobook distribution through ACX or somewhere like that. But basically, they kept it simple. Their focus was really on ebooks and cultivating that audience, and they didn't go out and try to place a lot of books in bookstores. Well, both of these two publishing houses were having a lot of success with the previous model, but when they moved into trying to get bookstore distribution, they both went with a company called IPG. I think it's called the Independent Publishing Group. Now, I'm not judging IPG. I don't know much about them. I'm just mentioning them because that's who both these companies were using. But basically, they will distribute your books both in ebook and in paperback. One of their big pitches is they have a sales team that will aggressively promote your books to bookstores and try to place them. And of course, they take a cut of your royalties on all the formats, including ebook. There are apparently fees involved to cover their sales team. And then the nature of paperback sales to bookstores requires holding money back against books possibly being returned. And what has happened with both of these companies, apparently, is that putting so much work into trying to market paperbacks has just cost them too much money. Basically, paperbacks sold to bookstores aren't really sold. They are taken with the hopes of selling some, and then a bunch of them are put back. And the way a lot of these companies work is, you know, they're holding money back against returns, etc. And it killed their cash flow. And here's how things are to me in terms of paperbacks. Yes, it would be really cool to see our books on the shelves of a bookstore when we walk through, or in an airport bookshelf, or wherever. That's a dream. But unless you are one of the big five publishing houses, I don't think it's practical or realistic to invest much time or money into doing it. And here are some of the reasons. Bookstore shoppers are accustomed to a $7.99 mass market paperback in the U.S. They're accustomed to affordable. They're accustomed to mostly grabbing the authors with whom they're familiar. Bookstores want a 55% discount on your books, and they want the ability to make them returnable if they don't sell them. Realistically, bookstores are shutting down. Space on bookshelves is shrinking. It's getting harder and harder to get much time on a bookshelf if you're not Dan Brown or one of the biggies. Obviously, bookstores need to stay afloat, So they're going to carry the books that they know they can sell, and they do spare a certain amount of space for newbies and sub-midlist authors. But, you know, as an experiment, go to your local bookstore and look for some midlist authors who have been around for a while, who you like, but you know are not superstars, and see how many of their books you can even find. Another reality is that even moderately successful authors, authors who have a little bit of name, only a small percentage of their books actually sell through, which means the bookstore manages to sell them to a customer. The vast majority of the books that are printed up for them are sent back to the books to the publisher, and the publisher eats that cost. They destroy the books. So there's just not a lot of profit in it. And, you know, let's say you're a new author or a midlist author without a lot of name, and the bookstore does carry you, because the publishers do have teams that try to aggressively sell these new authors also to a bookstore. You're probably only going to get a few weeks on the shelves. And if however many copies the bookstore ordered, if they don't have a decent sale right away, they're going to go ahead and send those back. You don't have much time to prove yourself in the bookstore space. And so that's with authors who might have a bit of a name, who have a name publishing company behind them, who have a very reasonably priced mass market paperback, and the force of the bookstore, of the publisher pushing behind them. And even they are typically not making a lot of money off of paperback, and they don't have a great sell-through rate. Now comes the indie author or indie publisher who's trying to penetrate that space. The reality is, if you're going through a company like IPG or any of these other distributors, you have to account for all their costs. So your book is going to be priced a whole lot higher than a typical mass market paperback. Somebody can grab a 350-word mass market paperback for $8. An Alan Baxter's book through Cohesion Press was discounted to like $16 for a 290-page book. I think its retail price was in the 19s maybe. I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but it was something like that. But basically, you already are in the hole because you can't price competitively as an indie, even through an indie press. Then there are all the other challenges you face of not being a name, not being known. Big publishing houses buy upfront space on the shelves and the little end caps to put their feature titles on. You can't do that as an indie. So basically what I see happening is a lot of publishers overvaluing the attempt to get their books into bookstores. Yes, in terms of audience segment, the paperback readership is a good bit larger than the ebook readership and the audiobook listenership combined. However, the money just isn't there per unit. And indies really do need to often think per unit, because you're just not going to get massive sell-through on your overpriced trade paperback when you're an indie or with an indie press. You're going to struggle to get much placement. And what I see is some of these companies, they're not only, you know, spending money through a distributor to try to place their overpriced paperbacks, they're spending money to advertise in trade magazines, trade publications, things like that, which is really nice for their authors. But the per unit value just isn't there for them. The deck is stacked against anyone other than a big publishing house really having much success in the bookstore space. Another thing I think I've cautioned you about on an older episode, but I'll say it again. If you're using Lightning Source or Ingram Spark and you're tempted to make your books returnable so you can try to sell to a bookstore, I don't recommend doing it, because the way it's structured is very punitive. You could lose your shirt. Study up on it for yourself and understand it, but I advise very much against it. You can make your books non-returnable, but if you put them through Ingram or through certain channels of CreateSpace, they can still be ordered in a bookstore. The bookstore is not going to order 40 of them, put them on the shelf, unless your buddy's with the manager. Maybe you can talk them into it. But somebody could walk in and say, hey, I'd like the next, do you have the David Wood book? And they can say, no, but I can order it for you. Be here in a couple days. And they might make the customer pay up front because it's not returnable. But, you know, like I said, I believe that overvaluing as an indie, overvaluing the presence of your paperback on a bookstore shelf can be a career killer. It can be a publishing house killer. It can kill your career if you're investing too much of your capital and time and effort into trying to either hand sell into bookstores or taking this big risk in trying to sell big quantities into bookstores. You know, use Ingram or someone like that. Make your book technically available, but I just don't think it's worth the investment. And again, this podcast is aimed toward people who want to make a living indie publishing. You know, if for you it's about the art, if for you it's about the vanity, and I don't mean vanity in a negative way. I know that word has negative connotations, but realistically, if what you want is that buzz of seeing yourself on the bookshelf, that is a vanity, although it is understandable. It'd be a great feeling. But as a business decision, I don't think that it's a great idea. I make decent money off of paperback sales, but really the books are just up there. They're listed on my website. They're mentioned when I send out newsletters. They're linked to my Kindle. But for me, paperbacks are found money. I pay for the cover art so I can use it on my ebook and my audiobook. And then since the book's already edited, it's already got cover art. There's no reason not to set up a paperback and put it out there. And so for me, you know, I don't try to put any of my titles in bookstores. I know from reports that occasionally they do get picked up and people buy them there. I know that occasionally libraries have them, but that's not where I'm going to invest my time and energy. Certainly not my capital, and that's certainly not where I'm going to place a great deal of risk. So I think you need a reality check as you're going on this indie publishing path. If it's really, really, really important to you that you be stocked in bookstores and that people who are the average reader who's browsing is going to come across your book and open it and flip through it, I think you need to aim for the big five publishers. I don't think it's realistic to believe that even a good indie publisher is going to have much success placing you in many stores. And so that is my little mini rant for the week. Now we're going to move to a little more positive. We're going to talk to a science fiction author who has really enjoyed a tremendous amount of success very quickly, and he keeps on going. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. Now we're going to chat with Terry Mixon. We are here with author Terry Mixon. Terry, welcome to Wood on Words.
Thanks for inviting me, man.
Well, some of our listeners might already know who you are, but most of us have no clue who that man behind the beard is. Actually, they probably
do. No one knows who the man behind the beard is.
Well, I just wanted to insult your beard at least once. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
My name is Terry Mixon, obviously. I write military science fiction, space opera, a little bit of post-apocalyptic. And what I do is I just write. I write stories that I think people would like to read that I have fun writing. And I've been doing it full time for 3 years now. And my goal is to keep paying that mortgage.
All right. Well, let's go back to the beginning. One of the things that I always find interesting is how people who are indie publishing full time got to where they are today. So just kind of tell us your story on your journey through publishing.
My journey through publishing started when a friend let me back up a little further. I'm a prolific reader. I wanted to write some stories that I had in mind. I've been a role player for 35 years now, ever since I was way back in the Army. And I just never got around to it. I'd buy the writing books and I'd sit there and I'd read them and I'd procrastinate and say, oh, one of these days I'll get around to doing that. And then a friend sent me his manuscript and said, what do you think of this? And it was pretty good. And I read it and I said, well, if he's doing it, I need to get off my dead butt and I need to start writing something, because if I'm not writing, I'm not a writer. And so I started writing erotica. And I published it to some free locations under a pseudonym because I could get some feedback on how terrible I was. And I was terrible when I started writing.
Okay, now you said you were into role-playing and you started writing erotica.
Go ahead and put those two together.
Yeah, okay.
Whips, chains. No, I'm talking about D&D, Traveler, superheroes, all sorts of role-playing in the military of that type. Although, you know, I didn't do any of the other role playing.
Right. We'll have your wife on as the other guest when we talk about that.
So that sounds like a plan. And once I got comfortable enough with how I was doing with the free erotica, I started writing erotica and selling it. And I did that for a couple of years and made decent money on some of the stuff, and it got my skills better. The practice of continually writing made me a better writer, and I decided to switch over to writing science fiction, which is what I read anyway. It was more what I would like to have written to begin with, and I haven't looked back. I've published my first science fiction novel about 3 years ago, and just have not looked back. It took off way better than I ever expected that it would.
Now, why didn't you get into science fiction right away? Was it feeling like you needed to develop those skills, or was it more that Erotica was doing so well before Amazon put it in the dungeon, no pun intended, that your hand was forced? What was that process for you?
It was doing really well for me before Amazon put it in the dungeon. There were months where I was making almost as much as I made as an IT contractor for NASA. So I could work at NASA, get my job, get my money there, and then I could go ahead and write Erotica and have a little extra spending cash on the side. There was no real impetus to go ahead and move to writing science fiction when the other was doing so well, and then it tanked. And so I had to make a decision of where I went from there.
Now, did you, when you had to almost start over with science fiction, did you have any notion that it was going to be as big as it was, as quickly as it was?
Absolutely not. I expected to put out the first book in the series and have it just vanish like a pebble thrown into a lake without a trace. And the response to it was amazing, and it actually made it onto a couple of the science fiction related Amazon bestseller lists, and did pretty darn well in the first month and a half. And it encouraged me to write the next book and publish it, which did better than the first one. And each one since then, while the individual books might or might not do better than that first release, every time I release a new book, the entire catalog picks up a little bit again. And the more often I release, the better it stays up.
Well, now let's talk about
I'm not sad about it at all.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your Empire of Bones series, because that's the reason you have a career now. Give us kind of the overview of what that series is about. Talk about how it started.
The Empire of Bones came to me as basically the universe there takes place about 500 years after the collapse of the Terran Empire, where there was this terrible war that virtually exterminated humanity. And the people that are the main characters of this story are from a world that was isolated and has no idea what happened after the fall of the Terran Empire. And so it documents their exploration of what's left of the Terran Empire and finding out that it's not as dead as they thought it was, and that things are worse than they possibly conceived they were. And it's a way of entertaining myself. I'll admit it. I take a lot of science fiction tropes of books that I've read in the past, and I don't try to recycle them. I just end up recycling them in there because it's fun. It's fun to take interesting story ideas that I think are cool and put in there and put the characters in real places that they would rather not be.
Talk about the genesis of that first book. Did you spend a lot of time thinking about it? Was that book already in your head, or did you just have kind of an idea that I want to write an awesome, fun science fiction book, button chair, start typing?
The latter. I had a scene in mind that ended up taking place virtually at the end of the book, where one of the characters has a major life change. And then I had to start writing the book at a place that made sense to get them there, and it took the entire novel to get there. And I had no idea, other than that one scene when I started writing, what was going to take place. I didn't have any idea who the other characters would be. I didn't have any idea, honestly, what they were going to find when they got there. All of it was what occurred to me as I was writing. And that's pretty much my writing style. I'll start writing a story, and it will change depending on the scene that I'm writing.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I feel like that first book has the feeling of a prologue in a good way. But it did feel like it was building to something that was going to set everything else off later. And that was definitely how I felt reading it when I got to that payoff moment.
I honestly anticipated that payoff moment would take place earlier in the book, but it just seems like no matter how much I think something is going to take, it takes about 50% longer to get there than it actually planned in my head.
Well, I'm the opposite, which is why I write so many novellas and short novels. Now, are you writing...
Absolutely, and that works.
Are you writing at about full length, 70, 80,000, roughly? Is that where most
yes.
of your books are falling?
The first one ended up being in the 70,000 range. Almost all of them are in the 80 to 90,000 range at
okay.
this point. I target 80 to 85,000 and see where it falls from there, but it's probably going to be at least 80,000 for everything that I write going forward. We'll see.
And how many books do you have in that series now?
7. The 8th one is about 2 weeks from completion at this point.
All right. And that's how frequently are you putting these out now?
Well, I've got about 4 different series that I have books in, and so it's been 6 months since I've put out a book in this series. I let my deadline in real life get in way, deadline for another work, and my life get in the way of getting one out, so it's delayed.
But adding to your overall catalog, you're doing that every few months though, right?
I'm trying to put out a book. My target is every 45 days, and I'm still sliding a little bit from that, but it doesn't end up being more than 2.5 months, and I'm going to trim that. As I get better at sitting my butt in the chair and doing what I need to do every single day, then it'll get better.
Yeah, I think that's a good target if you're able to do it and if quality doesn't suffer, which I obviously don't believe that it does because I try to write pretty quickly. But just tracking indie sales, I've always felt like 6 weeks, that's a good interim to start a new one, because after about a month you start to see the sales taper off a little, and you definitely see the impact on the rest of your catalog taper off within a month or so. And I've mm-hmm. always felt like, you know, 42 to 45 days is a great time to put out a new one.
Trying to tack up 2 books in a quarter, 8 books in a year, it doesn't feel intimidating. If I can sit down every day and write a couple of scenes, I will easily make that, even with doctor's appointments and any other crud that life wants to throw my way. It's just a matter of getting into the chair every single day and making the magic happen.
Yeah, and really we generate more words in a short period of time than we realize once we actually start writing.
Getting started is the hardest part.
That is, so how do you get started?
I turn my internet off the night before, and I start writing when I get up because I've got nothing else to do.
And, you know, some people might think that sounds oversimplified, but really just doing it is really what you have to do.
Getting started, putting yeah. those first words down on the paper is the hardest part of getting my daily words done for me. If I can get my butt in my chair in the morning and I get up before my wife does, if there's nothing on the internet to tempt me, which the internet is the devil for getting me derailed from doing what I need to do in a day, if I can just sit down, have my cup of coffee in the morning after I've eaten breakfast, and start writing, I'm going to make it.
So basically, I shouldn't be messaging you or posting memes before you've done your daily writing.
You can message me and post memes all you like, because I'm not on the internet. I won't see it. So you
right.
could rock yourself out.
Well, let's talk about, other than Empire of Bones, tell us about your other works.
I am involved in a collaborative work with science fiction author Glenn Stewart, and I just wrapped up the second book in a contracted duology with him a few days ago. It's off to the editor now. It'll probably come out December 1st, thereabouts-ish. Potentially, there'll be more books in that. It's been very, very good for me. It's his books, he's a much bigger author than I am, and his releases have done significantly better than any of my single releases. So I'm hopeful that those 2 books will not be the only ones in that. We'll see. We'll see what the future holds on that.
Yes, Heart of Vengeance, called, which is the – I'm sorry. I cut you off there. Go
I was gonna, it, that's okay. I was about to say what you were going to say. Go ahead.
Just say Heart of Vengeance is the first one, and, you know, it's been out a few months, and it's still way up there in the charts. And I think it's an example of something that we've talked about on the show as a strategy for broadening your audience. You were doing great before, but just from the outside looking in, this it took you to a new level because you got exposed to a new audience segment who obviously likes what you're writing, but it can be a challenge to get your book out in front of new eyeballs sometimes.
considering the number of people that signed up on my mailing list after that book came out and the interest in my back catalog that took place, it has to be that, because I've never had that much interest in that short of a period of time in any of my works. The book with Glenn did as well as my entire catalog on a normal monthly release of a new book in the Empire of Bones series, did virtually that by itself. And my back catalog easily doubled the best that it's ever done that month.
But, you know,
so I'd like to see that happen again.
Absolutely. But, you know, at the end of the day, your writing has to have the appeal that his audience is looking for, and it has to be good enough. So if you only saw a bump in book one and nothing else happened, that might be different. But obviously you had what they were looking for. And I think that's true in a lot of genres. Those of us who understand the tropes, understand the things that hook readers, and just like to give them fun, entertaining stories, it's really just a challenge of continually finding new pockets of readers who haven't seen your book yet, because we think, oh, we've been around for a few years, we sold X thousands of books, everybody knows who we are. They really don't. There are millions of readers out there, and Amazon's
a big pond. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And even now, it's been a couple of months since the book with Glenn came out, and every single day I've got 3, 4, 5, today was 7 people signed up on my mailing list. It's ridiculous.
In a good way.
And I love it.
Yes.
And I love it.
So how did this collaboration with Glenn come about?
I've been reading his stuff for a while, and I was friends with him on Facebook before this happened, and I assume that he's read some of mine. I haven't asked him, but he apparently thought that our writing styles were similar enough that I could help him revisit one of the original novels that he wrote back when he was 20 years old and maybe help bring it up to speed to where it might be useful, but he didn't have to spend the time going back and revising his own work. And so he messaged me about it, and I about drove off the road. That you should never go ahead and text while you're driving, because it's very dangerous when somebody sends you things like that, because I could not type yes fast enough.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, you know, I had a similar experience when I first went full time. I was making enough to exceed my day job, and right around that same time, Jeremy Robinson emailed to ask, you know, something similar. Do you want to collaborate on something? And my sales doubled when that book came out. So, yeah, you get hooked in with the right person, and you do a good job, it can make a big difference.
I know that having worked with Glenn, that our writing styles are very similar. There are differences in the things that we focus on when we're writing the story, but I think the two of us actually complemented each other fairly well in these two books. And if it goes further forward and we're writing brand new material, I really look forward to seeing how that works out.
Now, are the two of you both pantsers?
Actually, I think he outlines ahead of time, and then he goes ahead and veers wildly off the outline as soon as he starts writing. I just don't bother outlining ahead of time.
Now, did that present any challenges in working together in case one of you wants to veer one way and the other veers the other?
I was nervous about it, but it turned out that he was not as married to the outline as I was afraid that he was going to be. And so when I started veering off, he was reviewing the chapters as I did them in Dropbox, and he kept not saying anything about the way I was veering away from the plot line. And I asked him if he minded if I was going to veer too far away, and he told me that he wasn't concerned about it, and that if he had a problem, he'd tell me about it. Apparently he's the same way. He starts writing, and once he has an idea of where things are going, the outline goes out the window, and maybe he'll get back to it, maybe he won't.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, you talk about tropes and things that you like and things you try to bring to your stories. Give us some examples of some of the tropes that you really enjoy as a reader.
Oh, gosh, put me on the spot there.
Or if it's easier to talk about some of your favorite authors that fueled your love of sci-fi and military sci-fi and adventure and things like that.
I think some of the favorite stories that I've read are so dated today. I grew up reading folks like E.E. Doc Smith and Cap Kennedy back in the 50s. The books were put out in the 50s and earlier. And so that really colored how I was growing up in the late 70s. And yes, I'm that old. And I really still love stories like that. They're very simplistic stories. They don't have a lot of flowery dialogue in them. They're just telling the dang story and seeing what kind of trouble they can get their people into and just exploring the universe. If I have to say there's a trope that I like, I want to explore aspects of the setting that I've got the characters in and explore problems that the characters are having internally, with one another, with their environment. Just getting into the minutiae of that is what gets me excited about a story.
Now, we had your podcast co-host and our mutual friend Paul Cooley on last week, and one of the conversations / fights the three of us always have is having a freaking ongoing open-ended series once something starts selling. And it sounds to me like if the core for you is the joy of exploring new places, your series can go on forever because it's set in space.
It's true, and I've already looked at the scope of what I'm writing, and even if I somehow manage to get to the end of this huge conflict that I've set up, it will be dozens of books in the future, and I've already seen where the story can progress from there. It's the sky is the limit. As long as you can tell an interesting story, as long as you can tell new things and not just say the same thing over and over again, as long as you can keep being fresh, then your readers aren't going to mind. They're going to become invested in that sort of thing.
How do you manage to make each book fresh and unique when you're telling a massive conflict that's going to span a very long period of time in a lot of books?
I try to make sure that every book is focused in on a series of concrete things that the characters are doing. And every book is its own mini arc inside the grand arc of the series. And there's probably sub arcs that it's part of there. I haven't tried to visualize it that much. I'm a pantser, so this is all very vague to me as I'm writing. But as long as I keep focused on telling this segment of the story and make sure that this is not something that is virtually identical to something I have done in the past, then I think that I'm going to be different in how I do it. I really can't say how I make it different because that's the essence of being a pantser.
Now, you talk about the size and the scope of this series, and in light of you having worked with Glenn, have you ever considered allowing people to work in your universe, maybe to tell side stories, maybe to collaborate with you, doing something to where you're the one managing and they're kind of capitalizing on your level of success?
I have thought about it. I'm just not still quite sure of how to make that happen. I've written a couple of short stories set in Chris Kennedy and Mark Wandry's Four Horsemen universe. So I've seen it in action, and I've been part of it in action for their anthologies. And I'd love to do something like that myself. And I know they've expanded out to have other folks writing novels inside their own universes as well. And I'm very jealous, and I want to do the same sort of thing.
All right. Now, you have another series we haven't talked about yet. It's is it Freedom Express, Tree of Liberty? What's the name of the actual series?
Humanity Unlimited.
That's right. Tell us a little about that one.
That one is not exactly the most popular of my series, and I kind of knew it would be when I set out to write it the way it was, because it's set a lot closer to modern day, and one of the large aspects of this story that isn't part of the actual conflict with the main characters, between the main characters and the main villains, is things like Islamic terrorism in Paris, because part of the novel is set there. And some people didn't particularly like that. And the villains, they're a little bit more villainish and mustache twirling than I usually do. But it was a lot of fun to write. And the people that enjoyed it enough to go past the first book have stuck with it, and they've enjoyed it. But it was a risk for me, a gamble in doing something different. And I don't regret it. I'm going to still write the next book and keep going on that. It's successful enough to make it, so I'll keep doing it.
And hey, I think they mentioned Dane Maddock in it too, in the first one.
I think I did. I think I mentioned you in it because this isn't a Dane Maddock adventure.
Okay, well, I owe you a hat tip. I think I'll have Bones reading Empire of Bones and saying he got it just for the title.
There you go. Well, thank you.
Now, do you see yourself creating any more series and universes, or do you have all you can handle right now on your plate?
No, I've got a post-apocalyptic novel that I wrote that I'm going to write the next book to as soon as I finish this Empire of Bones book. I've got a book called Storm Divers that I could write more books in it. I'm not sure whether I will or not. And the back of my mind keeps going, you know, there's an urban fantasy that you really should write. And I'm like, damn it. Don't I have enough on my plate already?
So let's talk about your process, your writing and publishing process, because, you know, every indie does it a little differently. Take us through the steps. Which parts do you farm out? What do you do on your own? How do you revise and edit? Just kind of walk us through how you make a book.
All right. Well, the process I use right now is not the process that I'm going to use starting next year. What I currently do is I'll finish writing a book and I'll send it out to half a dozen people that are beta readers for me. And they'll send back their comments in a couple of weeks and help me find any of the pesky typos that always make their way through into these damn things. And then I'll put it together and I'll publish it. And when I started this, I didn't have the money to do editing ahead of time. So I've been playing catch up and doing copy editing on the books that I already have released. And finally, with the success of the novel that I have with Glenn, I have enough of a backlog of money to where, starting with the next book that I write for the post-apocalyptic series, the next one after this Empire book that I'm finishing, it's going to be copy edited before I release it, and I'm only going to keep a first reader. I'll finish writing the book. I'll send it off to one man who I really value his input into the characters, into the plot, into the story, and maybe make changes based on what he's saying if I agree with them, and then send it off to the copy editor and then publish it. So that's what my process is going to be in the future. I'm lucky that my wife can do the covers, so I don't have that part of the process that I have to worry about. Oh, yes, I do. I have to argue with her about covers because I change them at the last minute. That's what I do.
Yes, she's told me about her joys of dealing with you sometimes. Now, you bring up an interesting point, and that is that we need different types of support at different stages in our career, and it sounds like you're at a point where you're getting more comfortable with your storytelling and plot structures and things like that. And so that might not be the kind of high-level feedback that you need anymore.
When I started writing, and even today, I've discovered that I am the absolute worst judge of my own writing because I can't see anything that's interesting in the stories that I'm writing. I'm entertaining myself when I'm telling them, but they seem bland. They seem like they're lacking in voice. And that's because I hear the character voices in my head, and it's me. So I don't hear my own character voice in the stories, my authorial voice. And so I always thought everything I wrote was crap. And I've learned to just discount that feeling and say, they'll tell me if it's crap. They'll tell me if I made a mistake. If the readers are liking it, obviously I just can't be a judge on this, and I have to step out of that part of the process. And I just trust that it's going to work the way that it should work.
You know, it's interesting. When I'm writing, even while I'm writing, I'm hearing Jeffrey Kafer's voice doing the audiobook. So I no longer hear my own vision of the characters' voices. I'm hearing Kafer's performance of them because he's done so many books now for me that's just how they sound to me nowadays.
Is that an improvement or a negative?
It's better with the guys, worse with the girls. Now, let's talk about your actual writing process. How many drafts do you go through? Do you do the read aloud? I think you've mentioned using text-to-speech, things like that.
I've went through a number of stages of doing different things to go through my work. I've had the part where it's read the book back to me. I've done that. I've went through a period when I started writing where I'd finish the novel. I'd go back and reread it entirely and make changes as I went through and then send it off to the beta readers. And I discovered that no matter how many changes I made or I didn't make, none of the readers really commented on an improvement or anything being worse about the stories that I did not do those things to. So what I do at this point is, as I'm writing the novel, when I finish a scene, I'll go back and I'll read the scene and I'll fix the typos and maybe change a word here, change a word there, modify it a little bit if I didn't say things as clearly as I wanted to say. And when I reach the end of the book, I'm done. It's off.
Yeah, I'm at that point too, where it will go to what I call my minions, which is my street team, who's going to help me promote and post early reviews and things like that. And some of them catch typos for me, or they give me general feedback. But like I said, I know the story I want to tell and how I want to tell it. And by the time I'm ready to share it with other people, it's pretty much where it needs to be. And I was a little worried about that at one point, thinking, well, you know, what if I could be so much better if I were getting more support? Maybe I don't know how bad I am. But then when Alan Baxter and I had a traditionally published book, I got pretty much the same sort of feedback from the professional editor that I got from my hired editors, my indie editors, and my readers, which was basically minor details and little catches and things like that. So I do feel like I'm at the point where my story structure now is pretty good and my dialogue is good. I know how to handle my characters. So, you know, you just got to get the support you need, but also have, mm-hmm. you know, try to figure out what kind of support is needed. It's always challenging to know that.
And it changes as you develop as a writer. When I started writing, my own insecurities made me certain that I needed a lot more support than I actually needed, but maybe that's not true. I've had millions of words of practice since then. Maybe I needed that support back then. As you grow as a writer, as you get that practice in, you always have to be continually reevaluating your process and saying, where's the bottleneck? What's holding me up from getting the books done that I want to do? Where can I make it smoother? Where can I trim things? Where can I modify things? It's always an ongoing process. You're never done. Like your street team, for example. I don't have one of those, and I know I need one. So that's also very high on my list of priorities, to get something like that set up early next year.
Now, do you read your reviews, or have you gotten past that point now?
I never read my reviews. I got that piece of advice way in the beginning that you shouldn't. And when I was publishing the erotica under an online pseudonym, most of the reviews were positive. Some of the commentary was vicious. And I learned very early that was really hurtful to try to figure out, you know, did I make a mistake? Did I do something wrong? And then I just didn't want to go through that. If most people are liking what I'm doing, then I don't need to know what they're saying. If they're going to email me, then obviously I'm going to read their email and I'm going to respond. But I'm not going to go to Amazon and read the reviews there. I'm not going to go to Audible and read the reviews there. It's not because I don't care. I want people to enjoy the books. I'll look at the star ratings on the books and see how many reviews it has and what the average is and the breakdown of that. But I don't want to be influenced by the negative things in reviews and maybe the positive things too, because sometimes readers read things into the books that I'm illuminating, you know, character in the way that people haven't done before. I'm like, I don't know any of this. I have no idea what you're talking about. But it's just been a negative sort of thing, just reading any kind of reviews, and I haven't done it.
Yeah, you talk about getting feedback from readers when they email you. One of my frustrations is when a reader emails you and they're objectively wrong. For example, I had someone email me to say a book was riddled with errors. And I knew darn well that that was not the case. And you don't want to be defensive or anything, but after just a little bit of polite questioning, she was reading dialogue and identifying, you know, incomplete sentences and mm-hmm. things like that. It's like, oh, come on. You just if you don't know the rules, don't give the feedback. And the newspaper, for me, the newspaper people are the worst. If I don't know how it works out, but it seems like the ones who are supposedly identifying big problems are people who don't understand the rules of fiction writing.
I know that one of my favorite reviews that our favorite commentaries that I got in the email was when somebody emailed me and said that they could not continue to read my books because they were filled with the terrible cursing that was taking place and the terrible language that was happening. And I responded to the person. I said, this book that you're talking about, are you sure that you're talking about this book? Because I don't remember any of this taking place, but I'll be happy to look at any specific pieces that you'd want to have me look at. And his response was, never mind. It was the wrong book.
The one I get is because I like to play with biblical stories and biblical characters, and I hope I'm not repeating myself from last week. It's bound to offend somebody no matter what I do, or someone, or if somebody projects a certain political opinion. It's like in some of the Matic books, just because I want to be different, I'll have villains like militant Mormons or militant Westboro Baptist style people. And, oh, people will be all over me about advancing the liberal agenda, blah, blah, blah. But in the second J.D. Hara book, it was an extremist Muslim. And that didn't bother anybody for some reason. So I don't know. But I didn't get any conservative creds for doing that. But I get lots of anti-liberal hate for anything else. So
when I put out Liberty Station, because it had Muslim extremists in it, I got some emails about that. People were not exactly happy about it. And that's the aspect I figured would really nuke some people from enjoying that particular story. I had a character in Empire Bones, a secondary character that was gay. It wasn't even, you know, hardly on the screen any at all. And I got an email about promoting the gay agenda. I feel sad for the folks that find out that one of the major characters in the series that hasn't revealed itself yet is also gay, and they don't know who it is yet.
Yeah.
Surprise!
Yeah, my series is so diverse that I think I probably weeded out most of the people who are going to accuse you of forcing a social agenda down their throat, because from the start, my series has been, you know, African-American, Native American, people of Asian descent. But yeah, that's a hot-button thing, and it's like, okay, I'm writing about the entirety of space, and I've got one whole gay person, and I've done something wrong here.
The society is so wide and so varied that no matter what kind of person you're talking about, you're going to find somebody in your novel that is going to have some aspect that's going to offend somebody. And that's just the way it is. It doesn't reflect your own personal beliefs as an author, what you put in these. It reflects society. If you don't like it, well, I'm afraid this is the world we live in, folks. You're just going to have to adjust.
Yeah. Okay, well, we were talking about your process, talking about the editing. Your covers are done in-house. How about like formatting and things? Do you farm that out, or are you doing your own book formatting?
I do my own book formatting. When I first started doing this, I got my hands on a Word template that had kind of what I wanted as far as the ebook format, and I was satisfied with it. I've moved up to using Vellum, but I haven't published anything using Vellum yet, and my print books that I am so woefully behind on are going to come out before the end of the year, based on what comes out of Vellum as well. But I've discovered that I was needlessly worried about it. It's easy enough to get a Word format and upload that to Amazon and have it come out looking good. It doesn't look, you know, as fancy as some people's, but you can make it work.
Yeah, I agree. I do my own formatting as well. And, you know, there was probably a long learning curve, but I learned it on the way as I was developing as an Indian. I think that's something that people can legitimately do on their own. And, you know, you can get affordable formatting done, but why not do it myself? You know,
absolutely.
Sit down, watch a ball game and format my book while I'm watching.
Sure. One of the things that I actually made a Word macro that goes ahead and does most of the formatting that I used to change my stuff in the novel. So it's a one-click sort of affair to make that happen. But one of the things that we didn't talk about very early on is that I think one of the largest things that helped my success, continuing success as an author, was getting my mailing list link in with my other works in front of my story and making it the very first thing after the story was done as well. I did that in the very first book with me as the only sign up on that mailing list, and I credit it with helping me grow my audience from the very beginning, and far too many authors do not do that. You should.
Absolutely. You know, because we've talked about it, I'm a big advocate of putting it on the final page of your book. Don't even put in a page break, because Kindle automatically pops open a new window once you swipe past the end. So if you've got a page break, sometimes people don't see that. So yeah, absolutely put that invitation in there.
How does Kindle know it's the end? Because I've got other matter in the back. I put my other works again after the story, and then I've got a bio.
Are you putting the word "the end" on there?
I am not.
Then I don't know. Maybe it doesn't happen with your books. That's interesting. Because I listen to your books in audio, so I don't know what your
the next time you have a chance to look at one of mine online, let me know if it does, because if it does, I'll put it on the same page. But I have a page break in between it, but it's the very next thing.
Well, it sounds like it's not an issue for you. You're getting a lot of mailing list signups. But yeah, absolutely, that invitation to the mailing list. And then I like to put an invitation with a link to the next book in the series also. I don't know if you do that.
I do that as well, and if it's the last book in the series, I'll just say try one of the books below, because my other works are listed right below that.
Hmm. Now, you are currently exclusive with Amazon, so you can take advantage of Kindle Unlimited. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are you still finding it as lucrative as it was early on when you started out? Because I know sci-fi is really big in Kindle Unlimited.
It's not quite as lucrative as it was during the peak, because Amazon has been trailing off on the amount of they're paying per page. When it started out, Kindle Unlimited – well, let me answer your basic question first. Yes, I absolutely do find that Kindle Unlimited is useful for me, because barring new release spikes in sales, 60 to 65% of my income comes from Kindle Unlimited. So I absolutely am not going to go wide, because I can't see replacing that income with going wide. So I'm afraid that I am Jeff Bezos' towel boy, and that's not going to be changing unless something major changes in the meanwhile. But when Kindle Unlimited started, it was you have to read 10% of the book and then you'd get a certain amount of money. It was not as great back then. I'd make 25% of my income, 20, 25% of my income, but it was enough to encourage me that maybe things would get better. When it switched to per page payments, my income skyrocketed, and it's like I have a completely different audience inside of Kindle Unlimited than I do have on sales, because while based on the ranking of a book, both of them will go up, it just seems like you were saying, that science fiction has a huge pool of people that are voracious readers that just devour things inside of Kindle Unlimited.
Now, are you doing anything to advertise your work at this point, or are you strictly just cranking out the next book and letting it make the magic for you?
I've been cranking out the book and making the magic happen. I did a little bit of experimenting with Amazon ads, and I'm going to go back to it. And starting in 2018, now that I have a little bit of money in the publishing account, I'm going to experiment with new release Facebook ads for a week and see if I can generate something there. One of the things that someone else introduced me to, that would be a science fiction author, M.D. Cooper, introduced me to the concept of read-throughs, that just because you're advertising your first book, you can't say, am I getting my return on this one book? Because there's a certain percentage of people that will read book two for everyone that reads book one, all the way down through whatever the most recent book that you have. And so you can calculate from sales and from page reads roughly how much each person that comes along and looks at and finishes book one, how much that will mean going all the way through the series. And it's ridiculous. It's like, for Empire of Bones, the sales are like $12, $14 for every person that buys book one. I'm going to make, in the end, probably $12 or $14 by the time it's all said and done, and said percentage gets all the way through reading and buying the entire books that they're going to buy in that series based on how many people continue on from book to book. So it makes advertising for things like book one, and seeing that you're just not making any money on your Amazon ads, it makes it a lot easier to say that doesn't matter.
Okay, so just to make sure I'm clear, what you're saying is that you can reliably predict within reason that X percentage will love the books enough to read all of them, mm-hmm. X percentage will go halfway, X percentage will at least buy the second one?
Yes, okay. I can look at the sales numbers. I don't look at month to month because it's too volatile, but I can look at my total number of sales. And I can say, okay, I had, just picking random numbers out of the hat because I don't know them, if 10,000 people bought book one and 8,000 people bought book two and 7,000 people bought book three, then I can say if I make a sale in book one, that I'll also make $2.50 off of book two, which is like 80% of what I would normally get off of book two, and 70% of this, the retail price of whatever I would get off of book three. It's not a very complex sort of thing, but it's something that I'd never thought about before. And remind me to send you the spreadsheet for that, because it's actually very eye-opening.
Yeah. And, you know, that's why I feel, and, you know, my opinion has changed over time. If you have a series that's pretty successful and isn't just floundering, that not having book one for free is probably a good idea, because I don't believe you get the same kind of follow-throughs on a freebie that you do if people pay even a reduced amount for that first book. There's something about that investment that's going to make them more likely to read it and more likely to follow through. For example, with my David DeBord book, I leave book one free because that's the only thing that really seems to keep it going otherwise. But with Dane Maddock, I think I've done better overall by having book one just priced at $2.99 but not free.
Yeah. I found the same sort of thing that I think I – right now I settled on my release price for books is $4.99, and I've dropped the first book to $3.99. And it works. I make enough money off of it, and it seems to promote it. And I kind of cheated a little bit. I put out a book 1 through 3 omnibus, and I started off at the low price of $2.99, and the wave has just kept going. So I never raised the price. I just left it there. So said, I don't want to screw with it. It seems to be working okay. So I've just left it there. And I'm betting that it's leading people into the other books in the series as well.
Okay. Are you going to try for a book bub anytime soon on that, or are you going to hold off for a while?
I'm going to try for a book bub early next year. Hearing some of the scary stories about people that have had success being labeled as clickbaiters by Amazon has made me a little cautious.
Yeah. I haven't had it happen to me so far, but none of my books are in Kindle Unlimited. So yeah, I do understand the hesitation now. Okay. So what are you, when you think about what's made you successful, what, and you can put air quotes around it if you want to, if that makes you feel better. What do you think is the secret for your success? What's working for you?
I think it's a combination of things. I think that I told an interesting story that people were interested in hearing, that maybe it wasn't the same thing as everything else that was out there. I think there's a lot of nostalgia in the way I write my science fiction. It's very much older style science fiction. I don't dig too deep in this. It's action adventure in space. And I struck a chord, and I've just kept playing that and trying to continue writing that same sort of adventure story that makes me excited, and it's continued to work.
Okay. Now, one of the things we'd like to do to wrap up is give you the opportunity and also put you on the spot to give some advice to indie authors. Now, this could be indies who have enjoyed some success, indies who are just not where they want to be, or indies who are getting started. You can choose. Give us a little advice to indies who want to make a living indie publishing.
If you want to make a living indie publishing, do not give up. Sit down in the chair every day. Even if you can only write 15 minutes a day because of job, of family, if you write 250 words every day, that's a 90,000 word novel by the end of the year. If you don't start writing, if you don't put words on that blank page, you will be somebody who wants to write. You will not be a writer, and you will not be successful. If you want to be, if you've written something and published it and it didn't do as well as you like, that happens. You've got to just keep writing. You've got to put the next book out. You've got to improve your craft. Never give up learning. Never give up reading other people's novels and learning from them, picking up some trick or way of doing something that you think is cool. It's a continuing journey that never ends, and you got to have fun. If you're not having fun writing what you're writing the wrong thing, and you need to figure out what you want to write. Don't try to write to market, because if it's not something that you love, that's going to come through.
All right. Well, Terry, this has been fantastic. I think it's very helpful, and I also hope people can draw from inspiration from what you've been able to do. So tell us where people can find you online or on the podcast airwaves.
You can find me on Amazon. I'm the only Terry Mixon there. My author page on Amazon has all my books there. You can also find my static webpage at terrymixon.com, and that also has my mailing list sign up there, which there's no spam. You get notices of new books and when I publish something new or put something on sale. That's it.
All right. And tell us about your podcast.
I am a co-host of the Dead Robot Society podcast. We talk about writing and publishing, and we try to lure my co-host, Paul Cooley, into the modern age, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully, but it is what it is. He's a great guy.
Yeah, we suffered through him last week, so we know him now. All right. Well, Terry, thank you very much for being with us, and we wish you all the success in the world, and we hope you'll come back sometime.
I absolutely will. We'll have to get you on the show again. It's only been like, what, a couple week. Of months? We should have you back. Oh, that's right. I was sick.
That's right. It comes out today. Yeah, I was substitute you last week. So
you're a much better me than me.
It depends on the context in which we are speaking.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you.